This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, everyone. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. And this is the part of the program we call the Big Picture, where we try to take a lot of the dots out there. We're awash in data points, so to speak, as far as news and information. A lot of people are having trouble making sense of all of that, and that's what we try to do here. Now, you know, we have covered economic issues for the last couple of months, warning that the leading economic indicators seem to be going off like warning lights on in a cockpit instrument panel, warning that the economy is approaching stalling speed. What is interesting is there's very little conversation about this on Wall Street. Certainly did not come up in the debate between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. And if we head into a recession, and here's the odd part about it, if we head into a recession, the politicals are going to be blamed. That's the first thing. But we actually could have another financial crisis very similar to the one we saw back in 2007, 2008. And so at least if you're planning from the point of investing, you'd better understand that this is out there.
Yeah, it's amazing because the things that we're following in the markets these days, we're in the middle of Q3 earnings season, so people are watching how earnings come out. And, of course, the earnings are tracking that this will be or could be the sixth quarter of declining earnings that we've seen in corporations, with earnings peaking in 2014. But as always, just before you end the quarter, analysts lower estimates. The companies report the numbers, they beat the estimates, and everybody's happy. And as you heard in the first hour with our technician, Tom McClellan, and certainly it's a topic that has been brought up by many of the technicians we've had here on the program, is this is a liquidity-fueled market. It began with huge liquidity injections following Brexit. We had a brief two-day correction in the market, but then all this money went into the markets and it's been fueling it. And we've been in this risk on trade. And a lot of people are, John, I think, scratching their heads and somewhat puzzled because they're saying, wait a minute, the economy is slowing down. The numbers aren't even 2%. They're at 1% now. The economic numbers aren't looking good and the corporate profit numbers aren't looking good. Why are stocks going up? Well, stocks are going up because, quite honestly, it's the Tina syndrome. There is no other alternative. And so money is going in to the markets. And right now, it's being funneled in the risk on trade. But there's two things that we're following. We're following economic indicators, because sooner or later, if you, John, you know this as a pilot, when you get into stall speed, you either have to point the nose down and pick up speed, or, you know, you're going to be on the ground. And so that's what we're tracking. And I mean, I'm just looking because we're coming to the end of the month and this will be the first month of the fourth quarter. And we're tracking these economic numbers. We'll start getting October numbers here pretty soon. But, you know, this week, the ECRI growth rate is trending down. That's their economic gauge. The Philly Fed, which is a major index, that is ticking down. The New York Empire Index went negative this month. Auto sales have peaked, and we'll get into auto sales here shortly. The NAHB survey edged lower, and housing starts were down for the month of September. So we're getting more and more of these indicators that are telling us that we're in danger of going into stall speed. And the labor markets are also edging lower with fewer job formations. So it is something that when you look at how things begin to change, what you have to do is watch for things that change at the periphery before they start moving into the center. And one of the things that we follow are the LEIs, and also we have anticipatory gauges that sort of give us a heads up where the LEIs are heading. And from what we're seeing right now, it looks like the LEIs are about to peak. And once that happens, they begin to roll over. So these are some of the things that we're watching right now, John, that tell us we're approaching a peak.
Well, remember that people in elections too, Jim, just vote on what they are feeling. And what do they feel most of all? Cost of living, taxes, and jobs. Those are the three things they look towards government. That's where most of their interaction goes. And let's face it, right now we're told that the labor markets are strong. Unemployment rate is at 5%. And as long as that seems to be okay, we'll probably have the populace assuming that we're just puttering along.
Well, I mean, on the surface, you look at the unemployment rate at, you know, close to 5%. Everything looks good. But, and we've talked about the participation rate is one of the lowest it's been. Now, some of that is reflecting the baby boomers heading into retirement. But John, there's little subtle signs that we're starting to see. For example, the average work week is shortened. And what do companies do? When they begin to see a contraction in sales, or sales aren't going where they want, or profits begin to contract, the first thing they do is they cut the work week. We've already seen that in place. The second thing they begin to do is they cut temporary workers, because a lot of companies, especially as a result of Obamacare, where you don't want to have employees over 30 hours a week, and also because of a week, this kind of fit and start that we've seen in this economic recovery, where you have one or two quarters of good economic growth, and then the economy slows down, stalls until it gets more stimulus, or in several cases that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, we've actually seen quarters where the economy actually contracted. So we're starting to see, in addition to a shortening of the work week, we're starting to see companies let go of temporary workers, and that's usually the next step after a shortened work week. And then they start cutting workers themselves, and that starts to raise the unemployment rate. Now, a couple stories this week. Harley Davidson is laying off casual workers, or temporary hour workers, as part of their restructuring. Ford Motor reported this week that they are idling 4 factories in order to reduce the buildup in inventories. And the president of Ford said Ford is adjusting to the mature part of the business cycle. And basically they're saying auto sales have peaked. So what they're doing now is shutting down and laying idle 4 factories. So these are the things that you start to see as the economy begins to slow down, decelerate. So more and more every single week, we're getting more and more evidence of these things occurring and continuing. And John, you know, if it's 1 month, 2 months, you might say, well, you know, it could be something temporary. And we have seen that a number of times over the last, oh, I would say 5 or 6 years. But when you start seeing it take place over a year, over 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, now you're talking about a trend. And there's just all of these things that were put in place, whether it was QE, whether it was the economic stimulus. And you got to remember, the government is spending an additional $200 billion of stimulus this year. That was voted on in November, this being an election year. So the government deficit this year went up 34%. So even though the Fed has not been printing money, the government poured an additional $200 billion into the economy. So we're starting to see a lot of the stimulus that we've seen in place over the last couple of years start to fade.
Well, the candidates are both talking about spending money. It's just a question of what they're going to spend it on. But outside of the Fed raising interest rates, I'm trying to figure out what else might be going on.
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, we saw oil prices get down to $26 a barrel today. They're over 50. So the stimulus of lower oil prices is starting to fade as prices have increased at the pump. The other thing, too, that is starting to happen here, and this has been very subtle, and it's taken place over the last, let's say, 6 weeks or so, long-term interest rates are starting to tighten again. And that is a very serious one to watch, because we saw this happen in the fourth quarter of last year. As the Fed talked about raising interest rates, we saw credit spreads blow out. The Fed raised interest rates in December, and then all hell broke loose the first part of this year. We're also starting to see the dollar strengthen. And also in the latest Fed surveys of loan officers, banks are starting to tighten credit. So the other thing is, if you take a look at, we sort of reached a trough in interest rates. If you take a look at the trend in interest rates, it's hard to believe. In 2014, the 30-year Treasury bond was at 4%. Today, it's at 2.5%. This summer, it was at 2.1%. So we've already moved from 2.1 to 2.5. But for 2 years, you know, we went from 4% down to 2%. So interest rates dropped in half. If you take a look at the 10-year Treasury note, which is what a lot of mortgages are tied to, the 10-year Treasury note today is at 1.75% after hitting a bottom of 1.32% this summer. So rates are likely to back up, which is going to reduce stimulus before fading lower in a downturn. Because usually, as you get close to a recession or there's recessionary fears, you start to see a widening of credit spreads in the corporate bond market because investors are worried about a recession and the impact on a company's ability to meet its interest payments. So that's one of the trends that you see. And then what happens is the lower quality bonds, like high yield bonds, then all of a sudden those spreads begin to widen because there's the greater risk of default. And then eventually, as you head into a recession, interest rates come down on sovereigns because people are saying, we're in a recession. Where do I park money safely? And there is such a wide spread today between interest rates here in the U.S., whose monetary policy is in divergence from the other major central banks in the world, whether it's the Bank of England, the ECB, or the Bank of Japan, or even the Bank of China. So what we're seeing here is a lot of these things that helped sort of keep the economy alive after the Fed began to taper. Lower interest rates falling, like I mentioned, from 4% to 2%, or from 3% all the way down to 1.3% on the 10-year Treasury note. Lower oil prices. And actually, the only thing that is going right now in the form of stimulus has been government fiscal spending, where the additional $200 billion this year. But all of those things, John, are beginning to fade. So unless they are replaced with something, either the Fed starts QE again, the government starts a massive stimulus program, and we'll tell you why, if they do, it'll be too late anyway, here in a moment. But unless something like that happens, I just don't see anything that's going to be a catalyst for stronger economic growth. And in fact, if anything, if certain policies are enacted, whether Clinton gets elected and raises taxes, both on estates and income taxes, the Fed raises interest rates in December, those are negatives for the economy. So I don't see anything on the stimulus side coming forth from government. In fact, I see just the opposite.
Well, you know, even though the Fed has this 2% inflation target, what affects people out here, remember I mentioned that the things that where people are really concerned about is the cost of living, in addition to, say, for example, taxes and things related to that. The real cost of living's rising and going up. As a matter of fact, healthcare is going up disproportionately to the rest of the inflation items. But food's going up, cost of energy, all of these things.
Well, they're all going up. And we were in this sort of deflationary trend with falling commodity prices that began in 2011. You know, the price of just about every commodity was falling. It just wasn't precious metals. It was, you know, iron, ore, copper, ag prices, and then also energy prices, which peaked at over $100 a barrel and then fell all the way down to $26 a barrel. So, you know, what we've seen is this deflationary trend. And also with the strengthening dollar, import prices were lower. So now a lot of those things now, John, are starting to come to an end. And as we have discussed, which that's why I think if you add all of these things up together, and we'll get into some more leading economic indicators here, or in advance of the leading economic indicators that indicate we're approaching a peak. But as you take a look at these LEIs, as we've discussed here in the past, corporate profits peaked in the second quarter 2014, and just judging by the information we see flowing in on Q3, this could be the sixth consecutive quarter of declining profits. Likewise, we talked about the economy peaking in the second quarter 2015. We're now approaching stall speed. We're in the 1% rate instead of the 2% rate. There's no way we're going to hit the Fed targets this year of over 2% economic growth rate for the economy. You can't. The first two quarters of the year, we averaged 1%. We would have to average over 3% for Q3 and Q4. And there's nothing that I see here that tells us we're going to be at a, you know, a 3 or 4% economic growth rate for the balance of the year, just the opposite. So employment also peaked. If you take a look at the number of jobs that are being created each month, they're down by about 50,000 a month. this year. And a lot of those jobs are artificial jobs or hypothetical jobs as a result of the birth-death model, because one of the things that we've seen in this economic recovery is the worst business formation or new business formation in any recovery since World War II. So there are a lot of things that are coming to play here, and one that I think is real particular, because the one strength of this economic recovery has not been CapEx spending by business. It's not been investment. It's been consumer spending. You know, if you're a consumer, you've refinanced your mortgage, interest rates are at low levels, your housing prices have gone back up, your 401k plan is up. And so consumers have been a spender, but there's a worrisome trend that developed towards the end of last year. There's something called the restaurant performance indicator, and that has dropped and contracted into negative territory for the first time in 8 months. And it's an early warning indicator of recessions. And because, you know, you think of yourself, if you're listening to this program, you're a consumer. You're a little bit worried about your job. You're seeing that things aren't going well at the company. You're talking to neighbors. What's the first thing you probably do? You probably cut back eating out and saying, you know what, we'll just buy groceries and we'll stay at home rather than going out spending that extra discretionary money for spending, because your healthcare premiums are skyrocketing and that's cutting into your budget. Gasoline prices have been on the rise since the end of Q1. So gasoline prices are going up. Insurance prices, your cost of healthcare is going up at double digits a year, despite the claims from the White House to the contrary. And so those things are impacting you. Well, what do? You cut out discretionary spending. And one of the first areas that gets cut when it's discretionary spending is restaurants. Restaurant sales have been in steady decline, according to Restaurant Association, since the beginning of the year. We've seen a similar pattern leading up to the Great Recession. In the latest retail restaurant report, only 30% of restaurants nationwide have reported sales increases since August of last year. In fact, stores are reporting a decline not only in sales, but also a sharp drop-off in customer traffic going back to August of last year. So less traffic in restaurants leading to less sales. And that's a trend that's been in place, John, since August of last year. So that's why when you start looking at these kind of things, you look beyond 1 or 2 months, you would dismiss them. When you have now, what is it, almost a full year of declining restaurant sales, that's a trend.
Yeah, and one of the highlights that we always try to strike here is that a lot of the lack of jobs that we saw created by small businesses, remembering that small businesses produce, what, 80 to 90% of the jobs in the country, has been largely due to taxes and regulation. They're struggling to keep afloat in the midst of all of this. And that oftentimes doesn't come into the conversation.
No, it doesn't. In fact, this brings up another key indicator, and in fact, an excellent predictor of recessions, which is the NFIB survey. That's the National Federation of Independent Businesses. That's basically small businesses. Now, the latest report that just came out, it ticked down from 94.4 to 94.1. Now, if you look at that number, you might say, well, that's not too bad. But the bigger issue is the job openings index dropped from 30 to 24, the lowest level that we've seen in 15 months. And this, once again, is another indicator that's lining up to support the things that we've seen, a cutback in the work week, increase in layoffs of temporary workers. And now you're seeing job openings, a sharp drop off by the NFIB. So we're starting to get one more thing confirming another. And this indicator has probably been one of the most reliable indicators of a approaching recession. And the latest data suggests that the final demand in the economy may now be waning, implying a recession is nigh. And why this is important, along with restaurant sales, is this economic recovery has been powered by consumption and has been the only real growth driver in the U.S. economy, because it is not coming from business. Businesses are not spending. They're not building new factories. They're not updating plants, spending a lot of money on CapEx spending, which is one of the things that's confused economists. And they keep saying, well, you know, next half of the year, it'll pick up. And then it doesn't pick up. And then they start out their forecast at the beginning of the year. And they say, well, this is the year it picks up. Well, I hate to say it, it hasn't picked up this entire recovery. So what's the driver of this economy has been, as it always is, it's 70% consumption. And that's you and I, the U.S. consumer.
Well, let's face it, taxes are always a drag on the economy and regulation. And Washington doesn't seem to have gotten the message because they're talking about doing the same thing.
Well, I mean, they don't understand economics. If I take a dollar from a producer and I give it to somebody else through, let's say, a transfer payment, they think that that stimulates economic growth. Well, what you just did is you took a dollar from somebody that might invest it in a business, expand that business to create jobs, and you give it to somebody that consumes it. The problem is, once they've consumed it, what do you do next? You have to give them another dollar. And that's the fallacy of that kind of economic thinking. But it's one reason why you just haven't seen businesses spending money, and they're getting real nervous right now in terms of, you know, if I was a small businessman, you're talking about estate taxes going up, you're talking about higher income taxes coming. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to say, hey, let's go out and party and spend a bunch of money when the government is telling you the possibility that they're going to tax you more? And I think that's why you've seen a lot of CapEx spending hold back. But I also think that this recovery has been more on Wall Street than it's been on Main Street. And that's why I think companies have been reluctant to spend money. So if you don't have business opportunities, what do you do with all that cash you're generating? You do what we've seen. You buy back your stock, you increase your dividends. And that has been the trend in this economic recovery. Businesses are spending their money on buying stock and also increasing dividends rather than investing, which is how you expand job growth and how you expand an economy.
Well, I noticed that even the CPI is ticking up. And, you know, maybe that's why the Fed is talking about raising interest rates, because you look, as we said before, healthcare and food costs and everything else in one way or another are going up. But anyway, what else are you watching in terms of an indication of where we're headed?
You know, there's two things that if you take a look at this, once again, going back to the consumer, housing starts and auto sales have been a big driver of consumers upgrading, getting new cars, buying new homes. We're seeing the housing market start to weaken. The auto market has definitely peaked, and that's why you're seeing these cutbacks with Ford, as I mentioned earlier, putting four plants on hold now because they're building up in their inventory. The other thing we're watching is a slowdown in construction and also this rise in bond yields. It's hard to believe a couple months ago, the 10-year treasury was down to about 1.3%. Now we're closer to 1.8%. And also the 30-year treasury bond was at 2%. Now we're at 2.5%. So that adds further risk. And two possible things that could even do further damage is, number one, the Fed raises rates in December, as we saw the effects that we saw last year after they did that. I think they were surprised at what happened in the following 2 months of the year. And then also, let's say Clinton gets in, maybe the Democrats take over Congress, and they push through another tax increase that she's talking about that would put another weight on the economy and could send us into recession.
Well, if we stipulate that everything we've been saying is true, basically that the economy is approaching some form of stalling speed, the politicians aren't talking about that because, and even though you need to understand that everything that people vote at the polls are things that impact them usually in their pocketbooks or elsewhere. So that's the environment we're in. But now what does that mean for investing?
Well, I mean, what we've seen since Brexit, remember, we were in a risk-off mode leading up to the vote on Brexit because we thought it would be very disruptive of the economy. And what happened is we had that two-day correction, but then all of a sudden, the Bank of England printed a bunch of money. All this liquidity came in the market. And so we've been in this risk-on trade. You've seen it in small-cap stocks, very speculative stocks. You've seen it in a narrowing of credit spreads on junk bonds, between junk bonds and sovereigns. So it's been a liquidity-driven market, because what is driving the markets higher? And we've gotten a lot of emails. We ought to cover this in a on the record segment. Jim, I don't understand why stocks are going up. You guys are talking about the economy slowing down. We've seen some of the economic numbers. You know, corporate profits are going down. Why are stocks going up? Well, they've been going up because of liquidity. And you're also starting to see a narrowing of the number of stocks that are leading the market. Louise Yamada talked about that about a week ago on the program here, that she was starting to see more technical divergences in the market. And you're also seeing a morphing into what I call high growth stocks. So you've seen the stocks of Amazon, the Netflix stocks, kind of like getting back to where we were in 2015, where the stocks that were leading the market was a handful of stocks that were going up. So we're seeing that. So as the Fed begins to move towards a rate hike, I think what we're seeing now, reflected in the bond market and treasury yields and corporate bonds, is we're going to start to see credit spreads start to widen in corporate debt. And we're also going to see, I believe, greater volatility in the market going forward towards the end of the year and also going into 2017, and especially if the Fed follows through with the rate hike in December, and also if Congress changes and the new administration talks about raising taxes, that could be another thing that you would see where it creates a lot of uncertainty in the market. So what we've seen during this risk on play is we've seen the things that did well in the first part of the year when we were in the risk off mode, things like staples, utilities, telecoms, real estate investment trusts, all of those are going through a correction. And like anything else, when you're going through a correction, our markets tend to overshoot. So at some point, I don't know what that's going to be, but we're going to reach that pivot point as we approach the peak. And then all of a sudden, you're going to flip a switch and the market is going to change and you're going to see a rapid rotation. So you'll see risk on trades unwind very rapidly. That'll raise volatility and you'll see a movement into more safer sectors, or what I call low beta sectors, once again will dominate the market returns. And they've always been the place in market downturns and corrections. So the problem that we have right now is we're seeing these low interest rates have dampened investors' risk appetites and given the illusion that there's not much risk out there. And what it has done, and especially in the junk bond market, it's allowed a lot of these zombie companies that wouldn't be alive if interest rates were normalized, it's kept them alive because it's allowed them to finance their debt, roll their debt over at lower interest rates. And as you get into a weakening economy and the Fed starts talking about raising, then what happens is credit spreads start to widen. We've already seen them begin to widen on sovereign bonds. And I think you're going to start seeing that play through on the corporate market as well, especially in the junk bond market.
Well, let's get into specifics here, because if we're actually approaching this peak, what do investors need to do?
You know, I think it's time to start thinking defensively. It's a time to start taking profits if you have them and lowering your risk profile. You know, some of the more prudent and more thoughtful strategic thinkers that we follow, they're doing the same thing right now. They're getting defensive because, as we mentioned, this market has been going up, not based on fundamentals. It's not based on what's going on in the economy. I mean, it's being kept elevated ahead of an election, but what happens after the election is more important, because if we take a look at what happens, what's the cycle? Once the Fed begins to tighten, you see a number of things happen. The dollar begins to strengthen. When that happens, credit spreads begin to widen, stocks begin to fall, and volatility increases. And we've seen this cycle repeat. We saw it play out towards the latter weeks of 2015 when the Fed finally raised interest rates, and we saw it play through in the first part of this year in January and February until the Bank of Japan went to additional QE and negative interest rates, and the Fed began to change its tune about raising rates. Remember, folks, we started this year with the Fed in the markets and all the forecasters saying that the Fed would be raising interest rates once every quarter. Well, we've gone three quarters and they haven't raised rates. And so that leaves probably the month of November, unlikely with an election, and that leaves the month of December. So we could be doing a repeat of last year's cycle. The only difference is the economy has weakened much further than where we were at last year at this time. And there's a lot more risk out in the marketplace today than what existed a year ago.
If I were to sum this up then, Jim, I guess what I would probably say here is caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, understand the environment in which we're operating, and then make wise decisions accordingly.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everyone. John Loeffler here. You know, quite often you hear Jim and me discuss on the Financial Sense News Hour what we call the new normal. But what does that all mean in the real world when it comes to navigating the world's markets and economies in what seems to be a new and steadily changing environment? Well, answering that question is the purpose of our Investment Strategy Conference, which is taking place on October 29th in San Diego. The theme of this year's conference is Approaching the Peak and the Next Financial Crisis. For more information on attending the Investment Strategy Conference and getting this information, that will be October 29th at the Del Mar Marriott in San Diego, contact us at 858-487-3939. Once again, that's 858-487-3939, or you can email Crystal at crystal@paplava.com. That's Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at paplava.com. Just because things are changing doesn't mean you have to be an uninformed or anxious investor. Welcome back to the Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, many of the economic issues that we cover here on the program and the things that we think are coming, especially the probability of a recession next year, a lot of this is just not being covered in depth by the media or in the debates. And in reality, we look at the media as playing a big role in what we see going on right now. First of all, what has happened with the alternative media is many of the issues being kept alive have been kept alive because the alternative, meaning newspapers that are not the mainliners out there like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and things like that, have been keeping stories and information flowing that at one time would have been impossible. But the second deal is that the mainliners have actually pretty well shown themselves to be extremely biased in favor of one candidate, in this case, Secretary of State Clinton. And as a result, what they're doing, Jim, is they are only presenting, I call it, they're presenting some facts and not other facts. They're presenting some stories, but not all of the stories. In other words, they're just giving you what you need to make sure that the outcomes of what you think are the way they want it to go. And for the last 100 years, I mean, this is a first that we've gone back to that. Because remember, in the 1800s, newspapers would take political positions and you knew where they were standing. And then in the 20th century, they began to move in the direction of impartial news reporting, where they would report everything and interview various people that would give you a complete story. Well, what happened in the 70s and 80s is in the broadcast colleges and the news colleges, you began to see this shift of emphasis to making newsmen and newswomen what we call journalist activists. And that's what they are today. And this election just brought it all out. I mean, it just splattered all over the place. It's going to be very hard for them to come back and try to change that reputation. Part number two, as a result of what we see, you know, you have certain of the channels that favor the left, that'd be CNN and MSNBC. Everybody knows about Fox News, theoretically over on the right. People are only watching the channels that massage their own ears, the things they want to hear. And as a result, their ideas are not being tested in the crucible of debate and exchange of facts. And that's true of a lot of the online newspapers that you see as well. And really, ideas must be tested, you know, in the, what I call the crucible of debate, where ideas are proposed and counter-proposed. And that's not really happening. People are getting one side of the story, usually backing their particular worldview or their candidate. So this is the situation we have arrived at. And that actually has shaped the whole nature of this political debate. The other thing you have to recognize about the media, they largely operate, the main headquarters operate out of just one or two places in the country, in New York, Washington, and Atlanta. And these people all talk to each other. They all share the same views. I call it information incest because they're inbreeding, you know, all of their ideas. And the idea of what's happening in flyover land or elsewhere, that's not germane to them. So we really do have a media problem in this country, but it's actually shaped the whole political debate.
Well, it's turned into more of a tabloid presidential debate than anything else. And it just absolutely amazes me when we take a look at the things that are going on in the geopolitical sphere and also with economics, that these issues aren't being covered, John. And usually that's what you expect on a political election cycle, that the issues that concern most Americans would be discussed, whether it's policy, what are you going to do about the economy? What are you going to do about these overseas. And that's why I think the third debate, at least there were policy issues that were covered rather than the tabloid journalism of the first two debates.
So what we are going to do in this segment here is talk about the issues we think people should be talking about, but in large measure are not discussing.
And John, you know, one of the first issues, and I was surprised at the way this was buried in the news, and that is the deficit is growing again for the first time in 5 years. The deficit came in at close to $600 billion. It was up 34% over the previous year. And as you got into what was driving the deficit, it was basically there are three or four drivers now that are driving this deficit that is going to grow, according to the CBO, will start to grow this year and each year going forward over the next decade. One of them was an increase in spending on Social Security payments, because naturally you got more boomers heading into retirement. They're collecting basically their Social Security check for the first time. A second driver was a big jump in Medicare spending. The third driver was a big jump in Medicaid, because that's where a lot of the people that are signing up for Obamacare are doing so, coming in through the Medicaid system. And then the fourth was increase in interest, because remember, the national debt has grown by $10 trillion in Obama's administration. Just as Bush doubled the debt, Obama doubled the debt. Another way of looking at this, in the year 2000, the U.S. government had $5 trillion in total outstanding debt. Today, it's $20 trillion by January this year when the next president takes office. So these drivers are going to be there in place. Medicare spending is going to increase. Social Security spending is going to increase. Medicaid, interest on the debt. You can't keep adding more debt, and especially if interest rates start to elevate. So those things are now in place and are going to drive this deficit even higher, John. And that precludes a big jump in interest rates, because right now the government pays a little over 2.25% on all its outstanding debt. So another way of looking at this is every 1% increase in interest rates will cost the government an additional $200 billion in interest expense. Now, right now, they spend roughly a little over $400 billion a year on total interest payments on all outstanding debt. That figure is only going to get bigger. And so these deficits are going to start rising, which is why they'll say, well, we need more tax increases, which is what they did in 2012 when they thought the economy was doing much better. But I think, John, you know, from this point forward, and it's amazing because neither candidate, neither Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, were talking about cutting the deficit. Do you notice that that's all gone now? You don't hear Congress people talking about it outside of Paul Ryan, but nobody's talking about the deficits anymore. They're all talking about, whether it's Trump or it's Clinton, they're all talking about spending money, where if you go back 4 years ago and take a look at the presidential election in 2012, we were still talking about budget deficits because they were still close to $1 trillion a year. And unfortunately, we're heading back. The deficit for 2016, with the fiscal year ending September, was $600 billion. Next year, they're estimating it's going to be over $700 billion. And that's assuming we don't go into a recession. Because if we hit a recession, government entitlement payments go up because of unemployment checks. Oh, by the way, that was another indicator supporting what we talked about in the first hour. One of the reasons also that the government deficit went up, in addition to spending, revenues went down, meaning the government's collecting less money from corporations in corporate taxes, as corporate profits have fallen for six consecutive quarters. So nobody is talking about this growing deficit issue. In fact, it wasn't even mentioned. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week. Surprisingly, in this election cycle, nothing was mentioned about Social Security, which has always been in the debates. And every presidential election cycle, as far as I can remember, wasn't even mentioned. The irony here is last November, they did a patch on the Social Security Disability Fund, which would have ran out of money in 2016. So they cut Social Security benefits, and they're raiding part of the Social Security Trust Fund to keep the Disability Fund afloat for another year. And we know in the year 2020, Social Security is mainly relying on interest that it's getting on its trust debt that is making up for the lack of revenues, because there's only about, I think, what's the figure? It's 2.8 workers now for every one worker. And by the end of the decade, it's going to be like 2.4 workers for every one person paying into the system. So nobody's talking about this. And that just absolutely floors me, because what they'll do is, like anything else, they will wait until we're in a full-blown crisis when they fix things. That's just the way politics works in Washington.
And again, no one's talking about this particular recession. Remember that George Bush was hammered for the previous recession over and over and over again. But by the time we got to the 2012 election, it wasn't much of the debate content, even though we've had the slowest recovery since World War II during the ups and downs cycle. And here we are again facing another recession, and the conversation just doesn't seem to be much there.
No, it's not there. And that's the more surprising thing. In fact, nobody's talking about it. All anybody is talking about, well, the stock market looks pretty good. And so they're talking about the stock market, but they're not talking about what is driving the stock market. You know, if you're looking at fundamentals, it's not fundamentals driving the market. It's just basically central bank creating liquidity. So here's an issue that isn't being discussed. That, hey, the economy is in stall speed. You don't hear anybody saying, you know what, we're in danger and risk of a recession, and here's my plan to help us avoid one. Because one of the things that, you know, they're both talking about fiscal spending. The problem is, the only time you ever get fiscal spending, first of all, it takes both parties working together to get a fiscal package passed. The exception was in, I think it was 2009, there was widespread cooperation between both parties because the U.S. was in a very severe recession. But it generally takes a long time, even for a new president. Now, Obama was lucky because we were in a full-blown crisis, and he got his stimulus package passed within a couple of months. But the one thing that we found out is there weren't any shovel-ready projects. So typically, the stimulus package usually comes after you're in a recession, because the unemployment rate is rising, the economy is contracting, corporate profits, tax revenues are going down, and all of a sudden people are screaming, government, do something about it, and that's when Congress and the president will act. So even though they're talking about stimulus spending, it would take them for a while, especially with the divided Congress, to get it through, and by then it's too late. You'd be already in a recession.
And there are some other things going on, too. I mean, Dodd-Frank has created less liquidity. And also with the raise of minimum wage, which is always cheered on as a political factor, but that creates a downturn in available jobs.
Well, it does. And one of the problems that you have is with minimum wages going up to $15, what you're seeing in the restaurant business, especially fast food restaurants, there was a story here in the local press about a McDonald's opening up a new one. And John, most of everything is going to be automated. In other words, you go on your iPhone, you get an app, you order it, and then you go to this kiosk in the store and you order it. And they're just basically, they're eliminating jobs. You're seeing this in the warehouse business, both at the retail level and also in the grocery store, where you're actually having, like Amazon is moving towards these railroad tracks in between aisles of merchandise, where you have robots that are actually doing the stocking and then also doing the distribution of items that are being purchased. So more and more, as minimum wage goes up, a lot of these minimum wage jobs are being eliminated. Basically, anything that can be automated is going to be automated over the next 5 to 10 years. And so that is creating additional issues.
Okay, well, as far as creating jobs, Donald Trump did mention that he wants to bring back jobs to the country here. We know there's about $3 trillion in overseas profits because we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. It's what, about 35%, somewhere around there. And as a result, all of that money, sort of like an offshore fog bank, you know, is just sitting out there. It's not going to come here. And so no jobs will be created. And the theory is if they can bring it back here to invest in things, then jobs will be created as a result of that. But even that's getting some opposition.
Well, I mean, you know, the current tax rate is 35%, and that's the highest in the world right now. It's one reason. What happens with a multinational corporation, let's say you're operating in Europe, what you do is you pay European taxes on the profits that you earn there. But then if you bring those profits back home, then they're taxed for the second time, and they're taxed at 35%. Now, the argument being made for lowering tax rates is to encourage companies to repatriate that money here where it's invested. And, you know, here's the problem that the government doesn't understand, and I think Clinton doesn't understand. 35% of nothing is still nothing versus 15% of $3 trillion. It's a lot of money. So you're better off lowering a tax rate and actually getting revenues you can tax than having a high tax rate with no revenues to tax. And so that's another issue that is at issue here that nobody's talking about. What are we going to do? There's a reason why these growing imbalances of corporate profits keep rising. And you see it reflected in the way things are done financially. I mean, Apple is sitting on over $200 billion in cash. There's probably 50 companies that are accounting for the bulk of that $3 trillion. But Apple is going into the bond market. Intel's going into the bond market. Microsoft is going into the bond market. They're borrowing at 3- and 5-year maturities at interest rates in the 1% range. And they're using that money to increase their dividends and also to buy back stock when they're sitting on piles and piles of cash. And the reason it is cheaper to do that and finance it with low interest debt, which is, by the way, is a tax deduction for a corporation, versus paying out a dividend, which is already taxed. But they're doing that because if they bring that cash home, it's going to cost them a 35% tax rate plus whatever taxes they pay at the state level. And it's one of the reasons those cash imbalances are being built up and why companies are choosing to finance their dividends and stock buybacks with debt versus paying it out of cash and equity. And that's why, you know, right now there's close to $3 trillion overseas.
Well, we just had an interesting experience here over the last week or so, and I seem to have created somewhat of a row, but the insurance company that we're with, which is Blue Cross of Idaho, has sent out letters to everybody saying they're moving everybody into HMO plans. And what this means is you now have to pick a primary healthcare provider. And the sum total of all of this, however, is like if you have, say, for example, like we do, a concierge doctor, the doctor is not involved. He's not in the network. So number one, people are going to be forced to change their primary care physician. Number two, the costs are going up. And number three, the healthcare plan has changed. And if you go back through all of the promises that we were made, remember, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your health plan, and everything's going to be cheaper. All three of those things, I was just informed over the last week, aren't going to be true here for many people in Idaho. But more than that, for example, Florida has just granted insurance companies a rate hike. 30% of Medicare recipients are going to have their premiums bump up 23%. The private sector medical premiums are in the high single digits, and more of major companies have been dropping out of the exchanges because they're simply losing money. And now the discussion is, oh, well, you know, the plan's actually working. We just need to do some things to fix it. And of course, my response is you can't fix what was never intended to fly in the first place.
Also, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal not only mentioned the number of companies that are dropping out of the exchanges, but also now the premiums have been going up at such a high rate that more and more employers are passing that cost on to employees by either making them pay for part of the premiums, or they're going with new versions of their plan that basically is going to higher deductibles. So one of the ways to keep your costs down if you're an employer is you basically just say, well, we used to have a $500 deductible or $250. Now we're going to have a $1,000 deductible. So you're seeing companies increase the deductible, which is one of the reasons why. And I think you're seeing this being reflected in consumer spending, because these healthcare premiums are taking money out of discretionary spending. And this year, if you're single, you're going to get hit. If you don't have insurance, you're going to get hit with the $700 tax bill come April. If you're a family, you're going to get hit with $2,300. So, you know, what are families going to do? That's another reason we think we could be in a recession, because those taxes will be due when you file your April 15 tax return for 2016. If you don't have health insurance, you're going to pay those fines, those taxes, $700 single, $2,300 for a family. And, you know, John, that's going to start adding up substantial. Imagine when those taxes hit next April, what that's going to do to the economy and what it's doing right now. So once again, another indicator of things that we're starting to see here that nobody's talking about.
You know, also not in a lot of the conversation is what's going on at the geopolitical level. There are just really little subtle things going on throughout the Middle East about how the various powers there are squaring off for the next battle, so to speak. I call it the global nervousness index is going up. Europe is facing a euro problem. It's also facing an immigration crisis, which has put a lot of strain on society over there, not to mention strains between the member states that are happening. But things are radically changing. And if that's one thing I've brought out of the whole last week, is that we are really going through another paradigm shift, and most people don't recognize that. Remember that our military also is underfunded right now in terms of what it's doing. And one lesson that you have to remember is that a nation's ability to maintain its military is tied directly to its economic status. It was the collapse of the economy in the former Soviet Union that brought it down. It was the collapse of the economy in the Western Roman Empire that really was the base that brought it down. So if we're going to talk about border security and all of these things, where will the money come from to do that?
Well, I mean, Trump talked about doing something for the military, but one of the things that I think that could make this next downturn a little bit more precarious, John, is in the last downturn in 2008, we didn't have geopolitical risk as we have today. One of the things that you're seeing is this diaspora of terrorism spreading beyond the Middle East. For most of your lifetime, and I think most of our listeners, when we thought of terrorism, it was something that existed in Israel and the Middle East. Now it's spread to the United States, it's spread throughout Europe, and even parts of Asia. So we have that. And you've got, for example, you and I were talking this morning about some of these issues. Japan, because of a weakening presence in the South China Seas, Japan is talking about changing its constitution and rearming again. The Philippines have just basically said no to the United States, and they're cozying up to China.
Yeah, those are no confidence votes in the U.S. as a major power anymore.
Yeah, so because we're not reliable, and also, you know, we're not the only ones. If I can read that our military is contracting, I see it here in San Diego, because San Diego is a big military town. We have the largest Navy SEAL base. We have the Marine training camp here at Pendleton. We have a submarine base. We have 4 of our 10 active carrier battle groups based out of here. And we also have a naval air base here. So there are a lot of things that go on militarily, and we've seen the fleet, the U.S. naval fleet, shrink from 600 ships under Reagan now to below 300. So we just don't have the presence that we used to do the things that we have, and we've abdicated a lot of our leadership. And in fact, one of the big stories Friday in the news is Russian warships going through the English Channel on their way to Syria in the Middle East. So Russia is now retaking its leadership role in the Middle East, replacing the United States, as we've abdicated that role.
Yeah, and immigration is a big issue in Europe. It's a matter of dissension, not only between subpopulations within certain countries like France and Germany, but between member states, with the Eastern European states seeming to be most resistant to the whole idea. The other problem is the assimilation of the people coming in. It's a very slow process, and there's a lot of civil unrest because of that. There's a lot of right popularism that's coming out. I mean, with every movement, you get extreme arms to it. It doesn't mean the whole movement's extreme. But there's a blowback to a lot of the things that Europeans have been told for the last 20 years, ever since, say, 2000. And so this is really hallmarked very much like the Brexit vote, where Great Britain said, you know, we just don't need this nonsense. We're leaving. Now, of course, there was even controversy in Great Britain as far as that goes. But this is what you've noticed right now. You have a lot of crossover, people crossing over and changing positions that you never think they would take on before, and making alliances among groups that you think would never ally with each other. You know, so as I said, we are really going through a paradigm shift here.
It is a paradigm shift, both on the geopolitical front, but the problem is there are more structural headwinds today. And I think where the crisis centers are most likely to erupt, if let's say the U.S. goes into a recession next year, the dollar strengthens. This is going to create a ripple effect globally, just as it did when the Fed raised interest rates last December. And they're talking about doing the very same thing this December. But the next crisis points you're going to see in Europe, whether Europe holds together. We've got a vote coming up in Italy here, coming in December. So, you know, there's a possibility that Italy may be the next country to exit the euro. So the euro may be on the verge of coming apart at the seams. The Europeans are playing hardball with the Brits. You've got a situation in Japan after 2.5 decades of stagnation. Nothing is working there. They've got massive debt and an aging population demographically. And then the other thing is China. China has basically increased its debt fourfold since the financial crisis, and it's on very, very shaky financial grounds. So if there is a crisis as a result of what happens here, it's more likely to erupt overseas, John, and the three spots that I see are Japan, China, and Europe.
Well, two things you need to take out of this. Countries have gone through things like this in times past. I guess it's going to be three things here. Number two, despite all of this, where have you heard this in the political debate? But number three, if you know what you're doing and you understand what the data plots are, you can still navigate this. You can still make investments and have returns on them and do retirement planning and everything that you need to do. But you do have to understand exactly what's happening.
Well, John, you do, because the media is not doing their job anymore. They've become more like stenographers than anything else. And unfortunately, entertainment value sells. I mean, look at the presidential debates. Largest viewed debates in presidential history. But two of those debates had no substance to them. They were more he said, she said. And it was only the third debate, and I'm not sure if the audience was just as large. And I think it was, because I know that all three debates set records. But it was only the last debate that they got in any degree of substance, in many of these issues that we talked about here were not even discussed in the policy issue, but at least there were more policy issues covered. But we'll be here to talk about it coming up. Well, we'll know sooner or later in the next couple of weeks what's going to happen, who's going to be the next president of the United States. Right now, all things point to Hillary Clinton being the first woman president and our next president of the United States. And of course, now the issue is now turning, will the Republicans hold on to Congress and provide a check on the new president? And that's the other issue we'll be discussing after election night. And the other things we will continue to follow is what's going on in the economy and corporate profits. All of that we'll be discussing. And of course, the possibility the Fed finally raises interest rates after talking about it all year, almost a repeat of last year. Will they go again in December of this year? All that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.